speculators and gamblers.
All right, so let's, so Millie, maybe if you begin with Chaye Sarah.
Yeah.
Now.
Vayehiyu?
Yeah.
Vayehiyu Chaye Sarah mea shana, ve'esrim shana, ve'sheva shanim, shnei Chaye Sarah.
Can you translate?
Sarah had lived to be 127 years old. These were the years of Sarah's life.
Right. Now there's a beautiful...
Why is this complicated? Why is this so complicated? It's repeated and it's...
That's right, exactly. Why does it do it that way? And there is a beautiful explanation. I'm just looking to see if I can find the text. It's basically, it is that...
do you have enough light?
Yes, yes. I was just looking for a thing that I forgot to bring it. But basically, the idea that when Sarah was 100, she was as pure as when she was 20. And when she was 20, she was as beautiful as when she was 7. So that's the way Rashi puts it, if I remember right. And that's why it repeats the word Shana. 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. So each of those numbers is significant. And it's interesting the way it puts it, that at 100 she was as pure as when she was 20, and at 20 she was as beautiful as when she was 7. So, so that is Sarah Imenu. Our ancestress Sarah. Right.
How old was she when Yitzchak was born?
So she was 90.
Wow. 90 years old.
Yes. So the sages connect her death here with the immediate preceding passage, which is about Akedat Yitzchak, Abraham taking Yitzchak in order to offer him in the desert, but in fact he didn't do that. But she heard that whole plan was there, and that gave her a heart attack or something, and she passed away.
Oh.
So that's...
But depending on how you read it, she passed away after or before. Because I was always confused, when did she pass away, before or after? Because he never went back to her.
Right. So she passed away on hearing about the Akedah. So
it was a baby when he was about to sacrifice.
Well, that's the... So therefore, the way the sages understand it is that he wasn't a baby. He was 37 years old.
Doesn't make sense.
Or 27 years old. Oh, 37, because she was 90.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense.
No. Because by the description of the Akedah, we understand that he was a small child.
Not necessarily.
Not really. He took him, he carried him.
But then he went.
It doesn't say he
went
carried
to
him.
To find the goat to be sacrificed in his stead. Yeah. Small child wouldn't do that.
No, it doesn't say that.
Does it?
No, it doesn't mention that. There was a goat caught in a thicket.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, the popular consciousness is that it's a child. But if you look at other aspects of the story, straight after, Avraham is concerned to find the shidduch for Yitzchak here. Now, the rationale, why did he wait? Now here, after Sarah passed away, certainly his son Yitzchak is 37 years old because she was 90 when she bore him and now she's 127. Why should Avraham wait so long to find a shidduch for his son? Whereas if you say he was 37 when he was going to offer him up, and now he realizes, look, if I would have offered him up, it would have been terrible. He would not have left any progeny, any children. So I must find him a shidduch. So it becomes the immediate consequence of the Akedah is looking for a shidduch for Yitzchak. So So it's, you know, you can look at it this way and you could look at it that way.
Yeah, so if was she doesn't have it because of the Akedah,
sorry?
You would hear about her death.
Well, here you see her death.
Chapter.
Her death follows it. Well, the chapters are, first of all, the original way the Torah was read is without chapters. The only thing is there are sections week by week. The chapters were invented by the Christians. And because the Christians engaged in polemics with the Jews, and they said, it says in Isaiah 53, so on. So what does it mean, Isaiah 53? So the Jews copied the chapter numbers so they would be able to engage in these discussions and defend Judaism.
Mm.
That's the... But this is a different parsha. This is read on a different Shabbat. So the Shabbat, last Shabbat, finishes with the Akedah and the birth of Rivka. You see, when Abraham came back from the Akedah, he was told that Rebekah was born. So if you say that Isaac was 37 at the Akedah, then now it says that he was 40 when he married Rebekah, and that being 40 means that Rebekah was 3.
She would be 3, exactly.
Yeah, so she's 3. A little girl. But an interest, but that's quite perfect.
This is pedophilia.
Well, you know perfectly well, it's part of the Eastern world, even today. Who was it?
My grandmother knew, apparently, who she was going to marry since she was a little girl.
Mm.
She just knew. She liked
it says that, that Isaac did not sleep with her till she was 13.
Yeah, but it makes sense to suggest that Isaac and Rebecca were born more or less at the same time.
Well,
was a baby when Abraham tried to sacrifice.
Look, you can look at it that way.
Of course.
But as someone I recently met, on her email it says, there's always another way to look at it. So the sages have their chronology, which, there may be other views among the sages.
What he's saying is it's a healthier view to ignore this and to listen to what he's saying, because it makes us look better. to suggest that what you're saying, even if it's correct, in today's time, it's pedophilia.
But he didn't touch her till she was 13.
He still sees her as
pedophilia. in our world, because...
But this is why Shaul is saying, you know, maybe we should... You know, it sounds better his way.
No, but in the biblical drawings, I remember the image of Abraham packing Isaac on the back of the donkey with the woods.
But who drew the drawing?
Of course.
No, but whenever
I mean, all of these things are cultural streams.
The local artist.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. Authorship.
Hmm. All right. So then we have, so Sarah's passed away. And it's very interesting. You see, Sarah and Avram have this very close relationship. Earlier on, it speaks about Avram and Sarah and the nefesh asher asu b'charan.
The nonsense they did?
The souls, nefesh.
The nefesh.
The souls that they had made. And what does it mean, the souls they had made? So Rashi says, look, the literal translation really is the things, the slaves, whatever, that they had bought. But there is another explanation, a more meaningful explanation. It is that Abraham and Sarah discovered monotheism. They realized that there is one God. They saw around them people who worshipped the sun, people who worshipped the moon, people who worshipped other gods. And Abraham came to the conclusion that there is one God, and he began trying to teach this to people. And Sarah did as well. So Abraham megayer et hanashim, he would communicate, convince the men, Sarah megayeret et hanashim. Sarah would do the same for the women. So they both were active in communicating the principle of one God.
Hence the term, sort of a short.
Yes, okay.
And I thought I had a joint property portfolio.
Could be as well. Yeah. And so Avraham and Sarah, they're a very close-knit couple, and the whole point that the birth of Yitzhak, which is something miraculous, comes about through Sarah, a woman of 90, she is going to have a baby, even though her periods had stopped. But nonetheless, they began again and she had a baby. And even he was an old man, 99, and nonetheless he fathered a child at that point. So
it puts to shame the story of the virgin birth, you know?
What?
Okay.
Now, so now when Sarah has passed away, there is a lot of significance given to this. It reminds me of the Lubavitcher Rebbe when his wife passed away, Chaimushka. Suddenly, most tremendous, she was a very, very retiring person. My daughter saw her, but never spoke with her. She would be sitting at a window when my daughter would be going to seminary at that time. She would always look up at the window and glance at each other. My friend Rabbi Lou knew her well and would often visit her with his wife. But most people, I never saw her. Most people didn't see her. But once she passed away, the Rebbe began speaking about her, and there was a very, very strong emphasis on her, and thousands of people gave the name Chaimushka to their children. You can teach in a class where every single girl is called Chaimushka.
My family has a Chaimushka. My family has a Chaimushka.
Yeah, yeah. And they, since there's so many girls who have the name Chaimushka, so one is Musio, one is Mushka, one is Chaya, one is Chayana, and one is Chaimushka.
Chayas in general.
Chayas, right. Life, right. All right, so there's a very strong emphasis on Sarah, and so would you like to go on? V'tamat Sarah.
V'tamat Sarah, b'kiryat arba hu Hebron be'eretz Kanaan, ויבוא אברהם לספוד לשרה ולבכותה.
Can you translate?
Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, also known as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her.
Yeah, lispod is interesting. Lispod is to give a speech when someone's passed away, a hesped. So there were some kind of gathering of people and speaking about her. Okay, so then comes the buying of the acquisition of the Me'orat HaMachpelah.
Yeah. Which is becoming so controversial later.
Okay, so let's maybe go through the verses. Would you like to read, Rami?
Where did you get?
So we're at verse 3.
Vayakam Avraham me'al pnei meto vayedaber el bnei het lemor. Ner v'toshav anochi imachem tnuli ehuva kever amichem ve'ek Bara, meti milefanai.
Beautiful. Would you like to translate?
Your hug is very good.
Yes. How
I've got a reading age of a seven-year-old.
No, but you can.
Wonderful.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Abraham rose from beside his dead, and he spoke to the children of Chet. I am an immigrant and resident among you, he said. Sell me property for a burial place with you, so that I can bury my dead. Right in front of me.
Yeah, and not have her here right in front of me. In other words, to bury her, that she shouldn't be left unburied. So there's a whole thing going backwards and forwards about this buying of this place.
So he was an immigrant, what, an asylum seeker.
That's right.
Of a kind. So
no, he was a migrant.
Who was Chet? Who were the people that were the Canaanites?
Not the Rachitim.
Yeah, the can. See, there is. There's Noah's sons. The sons
Shem,
of Noah. Shem, Ham,
v'Yafet. Ken.
So the son of Ham is Canaan.
Right.
And Chet is one of the is one of the sons of Canaan. Mm. So the point is that he in verse, let's skip to verse 9. He's talking to these people of Chet, and he's saying, "V'yitani." Would you like to try this as well, Robin? Verse 9. So that's a few lines down, and it's three words from the end of the line.
Vaitenli. Et me'arat
ha-machpelah
asher lo asher bikse shadehu v'chesef male yitnena li b'tovchem le'ahuza.
So that's verse 9. Let him sell me.
Let him sell me the Machpelah cave, which belongs to him at the edge of his field. Let him sell it to me in your presence for its full price as a burial property.
Right. So now the sages say this was a specific cave that Abraham knew about. He knew about this cave because Adam and Chava were buried there. Adam and Eve.
Oh. How do we know that? Only from the sages.
Yes. Thank God for the sages. There's a story in the Talmud about someone who didn't want to believe the sages. So he said, all right, teach me Torah. He said, all right, this is Aleph, this is Bet, this is Gimel, and the man began learning the Aleph Bet. The next day they have lesson number 2, and he tells him the letters of the alphabet completely differently. He says, wait a minute, yesterday you told me this was an aleph, and now you're saying it's a mem, a nun.
So he said, that was yesterday.
So he said, look, you are dependent on the sages in order to know what is aleph and what is mem. So we are emunat chachamim, the faith in the sages, is actually the chut hashidra, the spinal cord of living Judaism. Because Judaism is not just a matter of an ancient historical text. It is a text, and the transmitters, the communicators of these texts down through the ages. There are written texts and oral texts. The written text of the Torah, and then you have the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketuvim, other writings, like Tehillim. They are fascinating in their power. But you also have the oral text, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Midrash, the Zohar. So you have this tremendous energy of texts, of teachings, and the teachers. The very word Kabbalah means receiving and transmitting. And there's a beautiful passage in the Talmud in Chagigah. It talks about the thing is not only to learn or to teach, it's to learn and teach. You learn from one and then you teach another. And that's the chain process. And everyone takes part in this. And I heard the Rebbe describe this in terms of the sun and the moon. The sun shines light onto the moon. But the moon also shines light. So each one of us acts as a moon receiving the light and as a sun giving the light. So that chain process. So it's the chain process around these texts and what do they mean. And there isn't necessarily a single way of looking at it. There are very often there are different opinions. And those different opinions, although we say that the reason why there are different opinions in the oral Torah which is why the Mishnah was written down, because people were beginning to forget. So it's due to some human problem, but also it has to do with the material. We are trying to reach for something infinite. Torah is infinite. God is infinite. Torah is the doorway which helps us connect with and make access to the divine. So that doorway has many paradoxical qualities to it. Beit Hillel say this way, Beit Shammai say that way. This rabbi says this, that rabbi says that. And that multiplicity is itself part of it. So even though we may have a halakha, this is the way to proceed in practical terms. This is the way to conceive it in sort of conceptual terms. But nonetheless, all the other opinions still have relevance at some point or other. And somewhere or other, there is a teaching, a discussion where some of the other opinions come into the picture and they are talking on that level and another one is talking on another level. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And the very interesting thing is, for thousands of years it was understood the Torah is a book. So there's a book, then we have the idea, it wasn't an ordinary book, it was a book like a scroll, a book and a scroll. Then was invented what was called a codex, a book with pages. Still parchment, but it's a book with pages. It's interesting that a book with pages, you can access whichever page you want immediately. A scroll, you have to roll it.
Order.
Yes. Whereas a book with pages, you can open in the middle, at the end, you can. But then when you consider the way the commentaries work, and they bounce about, you know, and it says this in this verse, but something else in another verse, and then in the Talmud as well, the Talmud says one thing here, but it says another thing somewhere else, and the Talmud itself starts discussing this. It's more like a modern phenomenon, like a website with hyperlinks, and you click on this, and then you click on that. And, you know, and the Torah is this kind of composite reality, which is giving us access to that which goes beyond our ordinary finite ways of looking at the world, and helps us appreciate the Gadlut HaBoched, the greatness of the Creator and of the infinite, and discover the infinite within ourselves and within other people. So that's all part of the process. So one part of it is the idea that Adam and Chava are buried in Ma'orat HaMachpelah, in the double cave, and Avram knew that, and so he wanted dafka that cave. And so here's the whole process of buying the cave, and it's a going backwards and forwards, and finally, if we go over the page,
I thought Chet was about to give him the Ma'arav free of charge.
That's what he's saying, but he doesn't mean it. He's saying that, yeah, take it. But then he wouldn't really own it. Would come a day not too far off. What right have you got? Ephraim, your grandfather, gave it to me. Well, what are you talking about? So he wanted to buy it. So if we go to verse, if we go over the page, to verse 14 and 15, Vayan Ephron, Shaul, would you like to read that?
Yeah, ויען אפרון את אברהם לאמור לו, אדוני, שמעני, ארץ 400 שקל כסף ביני ובינך, מהי? ואין מתוך החור בינינו.
Yeah, it's exactly like a bargainer. Can you translate?
It's nothing for us, huh?
Yes.
Who is counting? Yes. Ephron replied to Abraham, saying to him, my lord, listen to me. What's 400 silver shekels worth of land between you and me? Bury your debt.
Yes, Rashi says, between two good friends like us, you know, 400 shekels is nothing.
But in fact, it
was a lot of money.
But isn't it amazing that today, 3,000, over 3,000 years ago, there's still a dispute over this place?
Well, the Israelis made a very big mistake giving it back you know,
whatever it is, but there is a dispute.
What's the
but,
dispute?
But it was continuous dispute.
There is a dispute. People, and
there
the
was never
side
a dispute.
Is using these.
No, but people were killed. The Jews were killed there in the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, how many pogroms?
1929.
Were
there was a pogrom.
Exactly, but also in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And then in the 20th century,
in Hebron,
by Wolf Goldstein.
And then
the other way around.
So you were going to say the mistake was giving the land back.
There was a certain point when the
like
Israelis gave Hebron to the Palestinians,
the
which was a ridiculous...
But that's interesting, because is there a mystical reason why this place is a place for dispute that doesn't end?
Well, the point is that the Arabs see themselves as coming from Abraham. Abraham is buried.
No, that is all understood. But why is it that it continues? This is what I find
amazing.
Because Mashiach hasn't come.
Yeah.
Okay, that I can understand.
That is right, because the Israelis relinquished their authority, not only in Mevat HaMachpelah, but also in Temple Mount. Remember, during the Mandate period, the Jews could go down only to the seventh step, as far as I remember.
I remember very well. And I mean, I don't remember
Arabs
myself, but I remember the stories.
The Arabs were not allowed to go further.
Yeah, but okay, in other words, Moshe Dayan was the stupidest man,
yes,
just like Obama, I'm afraid. I mean, he really took us backwards.
He gave
the Temple Mount to the what's it called? The what? But the point is, the idea that there are disputes, you see, it's very interesting. You have a piece of land, and you have an ancestry, which is shared in some sense. So Abraham's son Ishmael is the ancestor of the Bedouin, and in some sense, seen as the ancestor of the Arabs. What? Well, Ham is different. You see, if the inhabitants of the land of Israel are from Ham, then as far as the Torah is concerned, they have no claim whatsoever. The point is, they are the Canaanites. They are the ancient Canaanites. And the point is that the Jews, the Israelites, should come in and take over from the Canaanites. But then you have the children of Ishmael, who is a Semite. Ishmael is the son of Abraham, who is a descendant of Shem, the three sons of Noah.
Yeah.
Yafet is like the ancestor of the Europeans, the Greeks.
Yaft
Elokim li Yafet v'yishkon bo'o'ale Shem. God made Yafet beautiful, like the beauty of ancient Greece, and it should dwell in the tents of Shem. That means that in the temple, there were three coffers in which the half shekels that people donated once a year were put. And those coffers had alpha, beta, gamma written on the coffer in order to have something Greek within the temple. So that's some kind of mixture over there. Then we have the whole thing, Hanukkah, you know, it can get too Greek. But it's, but there, but that's Yafet. But then we have Shem. So Shem is the ancestor of Abraham, the Semites. But from Abraham is also Ishmael. And the Arabs think that we falsified the Torah, and it was Ishmael who was offered in the Akedah, not Yitzchak.
Yes, and that's what they have in their Quran.
Yes. That's, which, you know, it's... But here we have a point. I believe that the fact that you have the shared ancestry is actually a point of meeting point. It's when you talk in terms of United Nations, and, you know, that's where it becomes meaningless. When you say, yes, we go back to the Torah, we go back to the Bible, and this is our right to the land of Israel, I think that is something that a religious Muslim is able to understand. It's a problem, but he can understand it. But if you say, well, there was a Holocaust, and then there was United Nations, and there was a vote, and that I think is very secondary.
According to UNESCO, the Jewish people have no link.
But you know something, I was talking to a very smart Israeli that runs the whole film institute there, the government one. She was sitting here a couple of months ago, and I was talking about a project about Jerusalem, and the fact that the world doesn't understand and doesn't know that there were Jewish existence in that city and in around the Judea for centuries, for millennia, from the beginning, okay? Mm. There was a destruction, they were burning,
but
they went back
Jews.
Afterwards, and there were always Jews there, and I know it for sure because one side of my family never left the land, never.
Right.
Now, she said, I hear what you're saying, but most Israelis don't know that. That's not what they
absolutely.
Say.
Yeah,
it's the Israelis that are not saying it.
Yeah, that's
mean,
the trouble.
Kind of
well, it's supposed to be familiar with Parashat Chayesah.
Yeah, but they know it's being taken off the school syllabus.
No, come on, we are talking about a Jewish existence in Jerusalem.
Let's say in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century of the Common Era, when there were Karaites in Jerusalem,
absolutely.
There was the Patriarchate, the Nasi,
yeah.
there was later a fight between the Nasi in Jerusalem and the Gaonim in Babylon, but it was there. It was
and it was continuous, absolutely continuous. Yeah. At some point, even
well, when the Crusaders came, they killed every Jew in Jerusalem, and the streets ran with blood.
Blood, yeah.
So one piece of evidence is that there were a lot of Jews.
Yes,
but it doesn't even stop there, because later on, whatever happened with these bloody thing, they were back there, and at some point, until at least the beginning of the towards the end of the 19th century, the Jewish population was much higher in number than the Muslim population, than the Arab population, and all this, not even
well.
Israel,
it's very interesting that your
Israel
very well-informed friend who runs TV section doesn't understand that. Herself.
No, but she exactly, and she said that most Israelis don't.
Well, that means there's a great problem in the Israeli education system.
Absolutely.
So Jerusalem is not mentioned in the Quran, is it?
No. Mm. No.
And in our Torah,
there's a Muslim tradition that Muhammad went there before he died.
Yeah. But it's never actually mentioned.
It's not mentioned. It's mentioned hundreds of times in our Tanakh.
It was meant that he had a dream that he went there to dream.
That he had a vision and a dream, yes.
Yeah. The point
being but they say that he was there. When I talked to Ribal about it, he's a very intelligent man. He argued, of course he was there. What do you mean? It's dream or not? He was not dreaming. He was there.
But the point is the fastening on Jewish... the clinging to Jewish images of holiness. If we said that the white stone pond was holy, would suddenly become a tremendous focus international. There's some sense in which this gateway to holiness is the Jewish thing. And then everyone is trying to grab the gateway away from us. You know, that we open this gateway, we say, Jerusalem is holy, this is holy, the Holy Land. And then that becomes a focus for very large segments of society.
That's why there is a Muslim graveyard outside the Shah al-Hamim, the Gate of Mercy.
Uh-huh.
Because the Muslims believe, according to the Jewish tradition, that the Messiah would come to Jerusalem
from through
that gate. And they wanted to be the first one to greet him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, there are fascinating ways in which the Islamic world connects positively with the Jewish world.
Oh, but there's so much hate now.
You have people, where was it? I think partly in Iran, partly in Morocco, non-Jews coming to Jewish burial sites where a saintly person was buried and coming there. Now what's happened over the last 100 years is politicization of Islam. That in order to be a good Muslim, you have to join into the political perspective. That's all as a result of the First World War, the destruction of the unified Ummah, which the whole Turkish empire, Ottoman Empire, and that's a wound. So so what's the sword? What's the dagger in the heart? Is Israel, the Jews in Israel. So that becomes symbolic of all the ills of modernity.
And who caused it?
The French.
No, Perfidious Albion.
Who?
Perfidious Albion. The Brits.
The Brits. Yeah, but the British and the French. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but well, the British are really perfidious.
Very
to everyone.
Cleverly promising it to both.
Yes. Yes.
I read an interesting article in Haaretz about Balfour's motivation.
Uh-huh.
It was really anti-Semitic.
Get these Jews out of here.
No, not that. Because his reasoning for making the concession to Rothschild was his belief in the worldwide power of the Jews.
Right.
And he wanted to harness that power against the Ottoman Empire.
That doesn't
the
mean
Germans.
He's anti-Semitic. He's believing in the Jewish power.
Yeah, of course.
No.
It's a standard anti-Semitic trope. In the late 19th, early 20th century.
We can add Churchill to this, because whatever he did was, again, so that the Americans, they have connection to Wilson and to the Americans, and they were all talking about it, Jewish money.
Yeah, but you know,
they believed
to exaggerate the myth, yes.
Mm. Because it served them.
Of course. Because in order to obtain the declaration, they had to do it.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, Ismail is presumed to be buried also in Hebron with his father.
Yeah, where?
Ishmael. I've got no idea.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting question.
Yes.
I'm surprised the sages did not discuss it so.
Maybe they did, but I don't remember. But I would have thought you would know what the Muslims think.
Well, I don't know.
Interesting. All right. Homework.
I know that the burial place of Moses, which is not known by the Jews, is next to Jericho for the Muslims. It's called Nabi Musa.
Uh-huh.
And they worship it.
They think it's there.
Yeah, they think that Moses is buried over there. They call it Abu Musa, and they built a mosque above.
I remember the place called Abu Musa.
On the way to Jericho.
Yes, yes.
All right, so now, let us see something else. So given that he has buried Sarah there, and we have the Me'orat HaMachpelah, we have this burial place in Hebron, which has been bought with 400 pieces of silver, and that is a piece of Jewish land there. So now we have another thing.
But it was still a Jewish land before, no?
Well, it hasn't yet been given to the Jewish people.
But he bought it from the son of Moses.
No.
You said...
Chet.
You said Chet.
Yeah, now Chet is the son of Canaan, who is the son of Ham.
Which is the son of Noah.
Yeah. Well, everyone goes back to
Moses
Noah.
Was a lot
this is crazy.
Oh. No.
He said that you said something about Rivka being 3 years old when she was betrothed to Yitzchak.
Yes.
How is it possible when she's they call her Ne'ara, and she's by the water getting water out of the whale?
All right, so she's a strong little female.
No, it doesn't sound right. Vanara, tov vanara, lo yada, tovat mar'eh. Doesn't sound. I don't know, it's very interesting how things are.
I once met an extremely precocious little girl who was 3.
Could she
very, very
for the
precocious.
Man and for the camels?
Yeah.
And that's what she did.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
But and the whole time I met this little girl, I was thinking, Rivka Imenu. She's like Rivka, a very precocious little girl.
Well, but Rivka was precocious at that age too, really. Could she draw
water for the camels and for the men?
Oh, she was quite
capable. And her face would be covered at 3 years old? Oh, I'm sorry, this doesn't make sense.
Well, at 3 years old, according to Jewish tradition, a woman is a sexual object. That's you know, so the whole idea of modesty, that's
really scary.
You know,
the Muslim will argue that she was Muslim, that's why she
but that's why she was covered.
Right. All right, so now we have, look at verse 1. Alan?
Sorry,
you can just say it in English.
The Abraham wife of Esau?
Abraham was old.
Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and God had blessed Abraham with everything.
Right, okay. So now, what it's moving towards is the idea of Abraham sending his servant Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac, for Yitzchak. Because whatever age they are, let's just leave that in abeyance, but whatever age it is, Abraham wants to find a wife for Yitzchak, and the way they seem to be living, it's not as if there are many women around. And anyway, he doesn't want a Canaanite woman for his son. He wants a Semitic woman. And that means someone from his own family, from Shem. And that means going back to Abraham's place of origin, where members of his family are, so that he can get a girl from the Shem, from the Semitic family, or more closely, Abraham's own family. And that's what he's trying to teach. That's what he's trying to teach, to achieve, through his servant Eliezer.
The choice was not big at the time, huh?
No, you're quite right. And so he is telling him, you must go and find a wife for my son Yitzchak from my family. But there is an interesting point over here. If we just look at the verse that Anna read, Avram zaken ba b'yamim, Abraham was old, getting on in days. V'Hashem berach et Avram b'kol, and God had blessed Abraham with everything. What does it mean, getting on in days?
Well, in English it says years.
Advanced in years.
That's irrelevant.
Yeah, but even so, it's already told us he's old. So what do we gain by hearing he's advanced in years or getting on in days, right? Now, today, 20th of Cheshvan, is the birthday of the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, a fascinating figure. And he taught very, very interesting Hasidic teachings. This is a book, volume one of a three-volume set of his Hasidic teachings, which began in the year 1912 on Shavuot. And it was a kind of continuous teaching, which I'm going to explain what that means in a second, extending for several years. Now, the point is, he wrote these very lengthy, profound, mystical explorations. And the way that he presented them to the public, it's not in a fat book that the person is, you know, has this fat book and, you know, are you going to read all those 300 or 500 pages together? Each week, he would present, Rabbi Shalom Dober would present a teaching based on the Sedra of the week. At the beginning of the teaching, he would begin with a question about the Sedra of the week. Then he would say, in order to understand this, we have to refer back to our discussion last week. And he refers back to that and then takes that discussion further. And in the course of that, he then shows at the end, so in the light of this, we can understand what our question was about the Sedra of the week. Then next week, it's next week's Sedra. He asks a question on next week's Sedra, refers back to this discussion and extends the discussion further, another 8 pages or something like that. And then at the end, he concludes it with showing how that answers the question on the second set. And so it went on for years in a most amazing way. Sometimes there was a gap in the middle, but then he came back to it. And it was very difficult times, 1912, 1913, there was the First World War, which affected Russia in all kinds of ways. But it was an amazing thing. So these are streams of discourses, very, very intense discourses. Now, I've managed to make a little summary of one of these, a discourse on this week's Sedra.
So he was the fifth time. How many were all together?
Seven.
Seven. Yeah. Rabbi Nachman Mendel was the seventh.
And there
it's
would
a
not
very
be
interesting eight. Number seven, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And there will not be an eight.
There won't be an eight. No.
No. The eighth will be the Messiah. No? A Mashiach.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Okay, right. Now you just read one sentence. Would you like to read the first paragraph here? The Torah.
The Torah tells us that Abram was old, coming on in days, and God blessed Abram with everything. Since we are told that he was old, what is added by saying that he was coming on in days? Literally, entering days. The question is asked by several earlier commentators.
Okay, Max?
In order to understand this, we should consider the topic under discussion in the previous discourse. Why did God create the universe through the intermediate stage of the world of Atzilut and Sefirot? Surely God is all-powerful, and he could have created the universe directly from the divine essence without any stages of intermediate spirituality.
Right, so now this is a question about the whole nature of Kabbalah. Kabbalah talks about the world that you have the essence of the infinite, then you have the world of Atzilut, of emanation, then you have the next world down called the world of creation, Briah, then the world of Yetzirah, formation, then the world of action, and then finally our physical world. This is central to the Zohar and the whole Kabbalistic enterprise, speaking about these spiritual levels coming down, 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 till you have our physical world of concealment. So why? Why should there be these intermediate spiritual levels? Why couldn't you just have God created the world? Which is, in a sense, like the non-Kabbalistic way of understanding it. You know, what does it say in the Bereshit? God created the world, and so you don't have any intermediary levels. All you see is God creating the world. Finished. So what's the point of this whole Kabbalistic intermediary dimension? Okay, Michael, would you next?
The answer is that God wanted to be revealed to human beings. If the universe were created directly from the divine essence, it would be much more difficult to realize the existence and presence of the divine. True, one might say, the fact that anything exists means that it has a cause, and going further and further back in the series of causes, the ultimate cause is God. But this is a purely cerebral, philosophical process.
Right, it's kind of abstract logical thinking. It's, yes, okay, so the ultimate cause is God, but it doesn't have any...
substantive.
Yes, it doesn't have any immediacy for the person. And the point is that the world, the physical world by definition conceals God. Because if it revealed God, it would be already a kind of a spiritual thing. The physicality of the world is a concealment of the divine. Okay, so Millie, can you the fact
that God brought about creation through the intermediate stages of Atzilut and the other spiritual world described in the Kabbalah, and that within Atzilut and each world is the Sphira, wisdom, gives the faculty of wisdom of human beings the ability to appreciate the divine directly.
Right. So in other words, these intermediate realms give us the opportunity to directly appreciate the divine, as if that there is a divine radiance within everything. And in fact, that divine radiance relates to us. There is a faculty, wisdom, among the Sefirot. The first of the Sefirot is wisdom, then understanding, and so on. Our faculty, wisdom, relates to that. There is a kind of a synergism. We resonate to the presence of the divine, and the wisdom, quality wisdom among the Sefirot, that resonates with our own sense of wisdom, and now we're able to appreciate the presence, this process. Would you like to go on this process, please?
This process of apprehension of the divine can be compared to a person who is trying to communicate some field of wisdom to another. Within the teacher, there is a level of knowledge which is beyond ordinary communication. However, when that level shines and informs the teaching which can be communicated, the pupil understands much more clearly.
Right, so there's the simple teaching which can be communicated, like the world, and there's a higher level, which is more spiritual, like the Sfirot. When we have some sort of appreciation of the Sfirot, it makes our view of the world different, and we can see the divine, we can perceive the divine in the world. Shaul, thus?
Yes, thus the communication is the presence of the divine taking place through the existence of the universe. The higher level is that of the Sefirot and the words of the Kabbalah. When the higher level informs one's understanding of existence, one can perceive the divine.
Right, so we perceive the divine in a sort of... Alan?
Thus Abram was old, but also he entered the days which the Zohar explains means Sefirot.
Ah.
Step by step, yeah.
The 7 days of creation are the 7 Sefirot. His age, meaning also his wisdom, was a kind which directly appreciate the divine through spiritual dimensions, which God placed as the
intermediary
stages of existence.
As a result?
As a result, God blessed Abraham in everything.
Right. Okay, so that is an attempt to communicate several pages of
the
complex discussion. But so that's a little snippet of the...
And he did this for 7 years?
For
Several years.
The Rebbe Rashab, I think they say there are 3,000 discourses by him.
Wow. 3,000 lectures as such.
Each one about, 7-8 pages long. And a very, very remarkable figure.
And how frequently were these discourses?
Every week.
Every week.
One every day.
There were gaps.
No, but if there were every week...
That's years...
20.
No,
the gaps...
Yeah, he became Rebbe. His father passed away when he was a very young man. He was 21 when his father passed away in 1881. And he died in 1920. So he was Rebbe for just about 40 years.
60 years.
50
a week.
Fifty a year.
60 years,
and he was only Rebbe for 40 years.
So he—that's a miracle.
Well, let me see. Maybe I've got the number wrong. I got it from. I've got some sort of history of him.
Well, he could have been doing courses in between as well. He could have. You could have done 2 a week. But that's not just the Parashah Shavuot.
2,000. I got the number.
40 years,
2,000 discourses. So that fits with 40 years. Here is a thing about him. Here is...
his poetry.
Yeah, and a fascinating figure. And he began the Lubavitch Yeshiva,
mm-hmm.
where they teach mystical teachings as part of the Yeshiva curriculum. So... boys of 14, 15 are studying these Sfirot and these spiritual dimensions. So. Right, so his birthday is today, born in 1860, and his revelation of these profound teachings is really, provides a very... I mean, it's a continuation of what Rabbi Shneur and the earlier, four earlier levels of Rebbe, but this very much has to do with the whole take that Lubavitch has on the world and this perception of the spiritual, both in people as well. Once you see the spirituality that's in an individual person, you can see the unity between people.
That's in the Hebrew calendar's birthday today.
Yes.
But he was not born in Nikolaev, he was born somewhere else in Nikolaev.
He was born, I think, in Lubavitch. His father lived in Lubavitch.
Which is where today? In Ukraine.
Lubavitchy, it's in Belarus.
In Belarus.
It's Chud Lubavitcher. Sorry?
I said I've got two brothers-in-law whose birthday it is today.
Oh, how lovely.
He's sick.
Is it his birthday today?
9th of November.
Today's the
8th,
isn't it?
Today's the
9th. 9th? Oh, I missed a day. Yesterday was the 8th.
So Lubavitcher.
No, but it's not their Belarus. Jewish birthday.
Yeah, not the Jewish birthday.
Minsk, Gubernia, I think. I mean, it used to be in the Minsk. It's
near Minsk.
Okay. Yeah.
What's left of it, you don't know.
What?
What's it now as far as the Jewish?
Oh, I've been there. I mean, there are no Jews. When I went in 1992, there were no Jews living there. But now it could well be that there's some kind of Jewish presence because there are many visitors coming. So they had like a little, they acquired a house there.
But there would have been Jews living there before.
There were, Nazis herded 5,000 Jews there, I thought, maybe less, and killed them.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a thing somewhere recording that fact.
So why the last Rebbe moved to Nikolaev? He was born in Nikolaev.
He was born in Nikolaev. Yeah,
but not in Lubavitcher.
It wasn't, no. He was born in Nikolaev, and then his father got a job as rabbi in the town of Ekaterinoslav, which later was called Dnepropetrovsk. Mm. So he was brought up, although born in Nikolaev, he was brought up from the age of 10 or so, 8, in Dnepropetrovsk, Ekaterinoslav. And then he left Ekaterinoslav in his 20s, and he spent some time in Leningrad with the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. And then when he married Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak's daughter, he and she moved
to
Berlin, first of all, for some years, and then in 1933 they moved to Paris. And they were in Paris when the war broke out.
The sixth Rebbe was not his father.
Was his father-in-law.
His father-in-law.
Yeah.
This is why the dispute over the books, where Louis Jacobs was involved.
That's right. Yeah, the dispute over the books was because the grandson of the previous Rebbe claimed that this is a very valuable library and some part of it belongs to me as grandson. But the view of the Lubavitch movement and of Rebbe was that this is not a personal library, it belongs to the Lubavitch movement. It was something that was made over as a, it's like the crown jewels. So you can't have, some distant cousin of the queen claiming some of the crown jewels. The crown jewels is part of the melucha, the malchut. So in Jewish terms, books are the jewels. And so they were the center. So that was the center of that.
What is it to do with Albert Jacobs?
The way to stop him, they had to take out a court injunction, New York court. And Louis Jacobs, by that time, was honorary professor at Harvard University.
Sabbatical.
And he was called in as an expert witness on the
on behalf of Lubavitch. And he he told me, you see, he's making the point that these valuable books did not belong to Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the previous Rebbe, as personal possession. Because, he said, Lubavitch is different to other Hasidic groups.
Mm-hmm.
He told me this himself. In another Hasidic group, a poor Rebbe would be a poor Rebbe. In other words, if he didn't have wealth, he wouldn't be much of a Rebbe. But in Lubavitch, it was different. None of the Rebbeim almost had any real money. And so the things that the previous Rebbe possessed, he possessed on behalf of the Hasidic movement. His daughter was asked, did these books belong to the Rebbe or to the Hasidim? She said the Rebbe himself belonged to the Hasidim.
Ivor Jacobs, they organized, we went to an evening, they had a sort of reenactment of the trial with this reading from the actual transcripts of what was said and arguments.
Fascinating.
Mm.
It was literally a transcript of the whole.
Yeah.
The whole time. It was a fascinating evening, actually.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And that is on the.